Good evening and welcome to Chicago Tonight. I'm Paris Schutz.
And I'm Brandis Friedman. On the show tonight...
The yeas are 27, the nays are 20.
City Council approves three police misconduct settlements costing taxpayers nearly $25 million.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we are totally out of order.
Despite objections, the Chicago Fire soccer team gets approval for a practice facility on the site of a demolished public housing.
Welcome aboard, buckle your seatbelt, and kiss your family goodbye.
City Council welcomes its newest member. Our Spotlight Politics team on that and more.
I mean, to many in law enforcement, this was a political ambush.
Lawsuits seek to strike down a major criminal justice bill months before it is set to take effect.
One of the stories we tell ourselves is that we're a land of immigrants. But in moments of crisis, it becomes very hard for us to live up to those stories.
The new PBS documentary series, The U.S. and the Holocaust, explores how America grappled with the rise of Nazism in Germany.
There was a real reason people wanted to run away and join the circus.
And a beloved collection at the Museum of Science and Industry is going up for auction. But first, some of today's top stories. Trump International Hotel and Tower in Chicago is part of the New York Attorney General's lawsuit against former President Donald Trump and his company. The suit alleges a, quote, staggering level of financial fraud involving much of his prized real estate. The lawsuit is the result of a three-year civil investigation into Trump and the Trump Organization. It alleges Trump, along with his children and executives, used a number of tactics to fraudulently persuade banks to lend him money. Specifically with the Chicago property, the attorney general alleges that since 2009, its value had been excluded from financial statements. They say it's because Trump did not want to take a position conflicting with his arguments with tax authorities that the property had become worthless. Prosecutors say a three-year-old boy is not likely to survive after his aunt allegedly pushed him into Lake Michigan. The boy's aunt, Victoria Moreno, is being held without bail following her arrest on charges of aggravated battery and attempted murder. Cook County prosecutors say the boy suffered massive injuries after being in the water for around 30 minutes. Moreno was arrested after she allegedly captured on video shoving her nephew into the water. Prosecutors say Moreno failed to call for help and claimed she didn't know the boy or how he ended up in the lake. Public officials and local organizations are working to support another round of migrants arriving in Chicago. The 74 migrants arrived here on buses from Texas yesterday. This brings the total number of people sent to Chicago by Texas Governor Greg Abbott to 801. During today's city council meeting, Mayor Lori Lightfoot pledged to include funding to assist migrants being sent to Chicago in next year's budget.
As part of our FY23 budget, we will be asking the City Council to provide additional resources to make sure that we can meet the moment that we are facing now and into the future.
And we'll hear more about today's City Council meeting shortly. And up next, the battle over the elimination of cash bail, so please stay with us.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
In January, Illinois will eliminate cash bail, money paid to release someone from jail as a guarantee that they will return for trial. But it won't go into effect if a trio of state's attorneys have their way. Amanda Vinicky joins us now with the story. Amanda.
Yeah, Brandis, you've likely already heard about this law and you're going to continue to. The drafters of it dubbed it the Safety Act. And it is, while the no cash bail portion of it is getting the bulk of the attention, it actually does a whole lot more of that than that. It is 764 pages long. And that, according to a lawsuit brought by McHenry County State's Attorney Patrick Keneally, it creates, changes, or touches 40 different state statutes, and that is among his and others' problems with the law.
This was, to many in law enforcement, this was a political ambush. You had legislatures who were sort of in league with a group of activists, many of whom just did not have a comprehensive or good understanding of what the criminal justice system was doing, who took a wish list and put it into legislation. And all of a sudden, at the 11th hour during lame duck session, they sprung this thing. They strong-armed and excluded prosecutors, as well as police, as well as other people involved in the criminal justice system from any type of negotiations. They forced this thing through, and now we're left with the fallout, which is a bill that not only doesn't make sense, but is a clear and present danger to the public.
Of course, those who are proponents of this legislation take umbrage with all of that, and we'll get to it in just a moment. Now, that state's attorney is among those who filed three separate lawsuits, also by state's attorneys, those representing McHenry, Kendall, or Kankakee, and Will counties. Now, each of these suits have variations, but are similar in scope. Now, that McHenry, the Will County lawsuit, that is, says that the quick manner and how the law was passed is itself a violation, because legislation is supposed to go before the Illinois General Assembly for a minimum of three separate days. Now, that is true, but in Springfield, procedural moves are used pretty regularly so that the requirement is met technically, if not in spirit. Now, the state constitution also mandates that laws are kept to a single subject, and the McHenry suit alleges that the Safety Act violates that by cramming in everything from police decertification to the bail overhaul.
The Illinois Constitution and what our founders thought that that was a bad idea and ultimately destructive. So they want these bills to be able to be considered on their own merits and not just crammed through with sort of pork barrel legislation.
We've tried very hard. Legislature has been very sensitive to not mixing different issues in that way. So we've tried to make sure that all bills are germane to one subject area. The Safety Act deals with public safety.
State Senator L.G. Sims was a lead negotiator on the law, and he also disputes another criticism that the bail changes violate the Constitution's separation of powers clause. Sims says that it is disingenuous for the state's attorneys to challenge the process by which the law is passed.
You can't have it both ways. You can't challenge the way that the legislature acts, and then by the same token, come back and say that the legislature is infringing on the judiciary's powers. It doesn't work that way.
Sims also says that legislators, including himself, were involved with an Illinois Supreme Court commission on pretrial fairness that was the precursor to the Safety Act. And he says the Supreme Court has been now working on the law's implementation. But Keneally says that bail is a complicated balance of interests, and that prerogative should be left to the courts.
That's especially true when you're talking about dangerous defendants who are likely to flee or not likely to comply with process.
His lawsuit also alleges that the Safety Act undermines the constitutional amendment that requires judges to consider a victim's safety and well-being when setting bail. Sims, however, says the Safety Act will make a marked difference for victims by, for instance, ensuring that someone convicted of domestic violence isn't released so they could potentially repeat just because they've got the cash to get out of jail. Sims says that these lawsuits are a waste of taxpayer money. He says that he promised early on to negotiate the various aspects of the law as they go live. And he says that has been happening around with what he calls implementation challenges surrounding cash bails elimination. He says that while these fixes haven't been made yet, it is because legislators have been being respectful of the Supreme Court as the judiciary gears up for January.
Which they've been having statewide hearings to address and listen to some of the implementation challenges. We didn't want to get out in front of that. So we wanted to let that process play out. It's unfortunate that the thoughtful manner in which we've been leading this process and going about this process has been usurped by political talking points.
He says that conversations between advocates, lawmakers, and state's attorneys are happening now, but he does say that all of the inflammatory rhetoric surrounding this issue has made that harder, that is, driving both sides to dig in their heels deeper. The McHenry County state's attorney says that he is not part of those talks, but he is following them. Keneally says that he had held off on filing a lawsuit until now in anticipation that negotiations would address his and others' concerns with the law.
nothing has happened. And so now we are at the precipice of this thing taking effect on January 1st. There's not been necessarily any guarantees. And now what we're hearing is that, nothing's going to happen till after the election because nobody wants to put their name on this thing.
Well, now, if it isn't already very obvious, yes, this is politically fraught and on both sides. The legislature, by the way, scheduled to return at the earliest November 15th. And yes, that is just about a week after the election. With that, Brandis, back to you.
Of course it is. Amanda, thank you. We'll see you later in the program for Spotlight Politics. Chicago taxpayers will pay nearly $25 million to settle three lawsuits claiming Chicago police officers committed a wide range of misconduct. That's after a dramatic vote by the Chicago City Council today. WTTW News reporter Heather Sharone joins us now with details about those settlements, as well as the rest of the action at today's City Council. Heather, welcome back. And bring us up to date, please, on the misconduct that these three lawsuits are designed to address.
Well, the biggest lawsuit will pay $15 million to the family of Guadalupe Francisco Martinez. She was 37 years old and had six kids when she was struck and killed by a car driven by a Chicago police officer who was continuing a chase that he had been ordered to stop. Another settlement will pay $9 million to Patrick Prince, who was wrongfully convicted of murder but spent 25 years in prison. The third settlement, also the smallest, turned out to be the most controversial.
Okay. And Heather, Alderman Nick Sposato of the 38th Ward urged his colleagues to reject the settlement that'll pay $900,000 to Dwayne Rowlett, who was shot by a Chicago police officer in 2017. Here he is.
I brought a little small pocket knife I leave in my car. This is like an inch and a half. I think this is deadly. I think this thing would kill you. It's pretty sharp. It's pretty pointy. I also brought a 5-inch knife with me. This is a 5-inch knife. This is what he was reaching for. This is what he had in his car. When the police officer shot him, this is what he was reaching for. This is what he was going to get to go do what? I don't know.
It's two knives that we know of at City Council today. Heather, what prompted Alderman Sposato to wave a 5-inch knife on the floor of City Council floor?
Well, he was hoping to convince his colleagues to reject that $900,000 settlement, which he said had really angered him because there was a knife found in the car with the man who was shot by police. But there's no evidence that that man, as the alderman said, was reaching for that knife. And ultimately, the city could not defend the shooting, which left this man gravely injured. It was quite a moment today.
So $25 million, you know, it's a lot of money. Is it a significant amount to pay to resolve three lawsuits?
It is. Every year, the city sets aside roughly $82 million to cover the cost of settling lawsuits that allege misconduct by members of the Chicago Police Department. So just today, the settlements approved by the City Council account for more than 30% of that annual budget.
$82 million a year, she said. So also today, City Council approved a measure designed to protect abortion access in Chicago. What are the changes that are now in effect?
Chicago police are now banned from helping other states investigate people who travel to Chicago for abortions or gender-affirming care. This was a law authored by Alderman Rosina Rodriguez-Sanchez that was modeled on the city's protections for undocumented immigrants.
Okay, Heather. All right. Thanks so much. And of course, we'll see you again later in the program for Spotlight Politics. And you can read Heather's full story on our website. It's all at WTTW.com/news. And now to Paris and a follow-up to some reporting we did earlier this year. Paris.
Thanks, Brandis. After some aldermanic maneuvering, a controversial deal set to turn vacant Chicago Housing Authority land on the Near West Side into a Chicago Fire practice facility passed City Council. It's a story WTTW and ProPublica first reported on in June. The deal faced an uncertain future after a failed committee vote yesterday, but it passed the panel this morning after an overnight recess. After sometimes heated debate on the floor, the deal cleared the full City Council 37-11. And joining us to explain the background of this deal and break down what happened in city council, our ProPublica reporter Mick Dumke and WTTW News reporter Nick Blumberg. Mick and Nick, welcome here. Mick, remind us what the Chicago Fire is planning to build on this former CHA site.
Yeah, Paris. The Chicago Fire wants to build a practice facility, which would include multiple practice fields. I think six was the latest count, as well as a training center and some meeting space. And this whole thing would take up the better part of 25, 26 acres in the middle of what used to be the Abla Homes public housing development.
And Nick, this plan failed to pass committee yesterday, and then a few votes flipped. It passed today. What happened?
That's right. And it was a bit of a surprise that yesterday's vote failed. You know, Mayor Lightfoot supports this. The CHA supports it. The deal had already cleared the Chicago Plan Commission. But that's right. When it came up in the zoning committee yesterday, it failed on a 7-5 vote in a bit of aldermanic maneuvering that might seem familiar from your time as our City Hall reporter. The committee's chair, Alderman Tom Tunney, recessed that committee meeting until this morning. They got back together about a half an hour before the full city council meeting. Three alder people changed their vote and it passed. You know, there's a lot of conversation both yesterday and today about why are we building this soccer facility on land that used to have Chicago Housing Authority residents living on it? Why are we, you know, turning this over, leasing this land to a private sports team, particularly one that's owned by Joe Mansueto, a billionaire? Nevertheless, despite those objections, it ended up clearing the full city council this afternoon.
And as I understand, that was the subject of a very long aldermanic debate this afternoon on the council floor. Alderman Jason Irvin said there have indeed been efforts to rebuild or build new housing in that area. But then opponents said that the CHA's failures mean the deal should not go forward. Take a look.
I think that the progress in that development has been made. Now, I do understand that others have some challenges, but please do not hold that against the residents of the Brooks Homes and Loomis Courts apartments.
I don't want to hold this against your constituents, but we got to be able to hold CHA accountable, and we haven't. Myself sat on a CHA waiting list for 29 years. I have a kid that's 29 years old. And so what if I waited? Would me and my children be homeless?
So a lot of folks are on the CHA wait list right now. Mick, remind us what happened to the Abla Homes that were on this site and why it never really got redeveloped.
Yeah, there was one point in time, 3,600 families lived at Abla on the near west side over near University of Illinois, Chicago. The medical campus is just west of there. So at one point in time, this is one of the larger housing developments in the CHA's portfolio. But in the year 2000, the CHA undertook this citywide, what they call the transformation of public housing, which really boiled down to raising dozens of buildings citywide, displacing thousands of residents. And that's what happened in Abla. Most of the old public housing buildings were demolished. Thousands of people had to find new places to live. And the CHA promised that it would rebuild the community with about 2,400 units of new mixed income housing for a variety of people with a variety of backgrounds. But so far, fewer than a third of those units have been built. And that's what's really got people hot, is that even aside from the merits of this particular proposal with the Chicago Fire, that the CHA has repeatedly had delays and broken promises about its plans to bring people back to the area and build new affordable homes.
Yeah, the plans seem to be very opaque. And as we mentioned, tens of thousands on the wait list here to get into CHA housing. Nick, this kind of falls into this debate over aldermanic privilege. Explain that.
It certainly does. There was a lot of conversation about that as well when the measure came up for a vote before the full city council. Alderman Jason Irvin, in whose ward this development sits, said, you know, this is something that I support. I think it's a great idea. It's something that the residents, particularly the CHA residents still in the area, would benefit from and that they support. You know, obviously there's a bit of debate about that, considering the fact that there are many people that were, you know, no longer living on that site. There are also plenty of folks who haven't really heard about this effort. But nevertheless, he said, this is something that's got the backing of the community. It's going to be a benefit to us. And you should trust me. You should listen to me. This is my ward. I know what's going on here. So he garnered a pretty surprisingly wide array of support from folks. I mean, there were fellow Westsiders like Emma Mitz and Walter Burnett Jr., but you also heard from Alderman Ray Lopez, Alderman Nick Spezzato, Anthony Napolitano. Now, what was interesting is that Napolitano actually raised the fact that back in December, there was a housing development in his ward that got passed, one that he did not support, but it got passed over his aldermanic privilege. And he stood up and said, look, I told you this was going to happen. Eventually, it was going to come for your ward. But nevertheless, I trust my colleague, Alderman Urban, and I am going to vote to support this, as did many others of Urban's colleagues.
Aldermanic privilege still in effect in some instances. Mick Dumke, so the plan is done. It's passed. It's got the approval. What's the timeline here to build it?
Well, the Chicago Fire has said that it would like to break ground on the new facility by late winter or next spring. There's a couple more hoops that still have to be jumped through by the city and the CHA. The biggest one is that any use of public housing land for purposes other than housing has to get approval from the federal government. So the CHA said to me just a little while ago that they have gone ahead and submitted an application to the Department of Housing and Urban Development to get approval for this deal with the fire. That could take weeks, it could take months, but as the past indicates, HUD usually signs off on these kinds of things if the CHA shows that it has some kind of resident support and it has the backing of elected officials, which they got today.
So it seems like it might be a perfunctory step, but we'll see. Our thanks to Mick Dumke and Nick Blumberg. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Paris.
And up next, a beloved collection at the Museum of Science and Industry is going up for auction. We'll share which one right after this.
We've made it.
Justice Jackson's appointment to the Supreme Court provides a beacon of hope.
Black women are underrepresented. We still rise. We still show up for one another.
It's us investing in the next generation and giving them something to enrich the next generation with.
And there's much more ahead on the program, including our Spotlight Politics team on the bribery charges against State Senator Emil Jones III. But first, an auction house is preparing to say goodbye to a collection of figurines that once symbolized doing the impossible. The auction features pieces from a popular exhibit at the Museum of Science and Industry. The museum hopes that the selling of its memorabilia will allow fans to experience the greatest show on earth from the comfort of their own home. Arts correspondent Angel Edo reports from the Big Top.
Circuses pushed what we thought our limits and our abilities were. You wouldn't imagine could be done unless you saw them.
After more than 40 years, the Big Top at the Museum of Science and Industry is packing up for good. It's a collection of a massive miniature circus that initially consisted of 22,000 figurines. Created by Chicago rail worker Roland J. Weber, it's said to have taken 3 decades to complete.
In 1920, when he started, if you can imagine, people didn't have television, they might have had a radio, there wasn't a lot of opportunities for entertainment, especially if you lived in a small town. So a circus coming to town with thousands of people, exotic acts, just spectacle, must have been game-changing.
Auction items for sale include several motorized dioramas that portray acts performed by hand-carved acrobats, clowns, and animals, and other interactive elements that reflect how the circus also served as an educational tool when it came to town.
The circus is an incredible industry. It employed thousands of people, it used innovative business models, and it often introduced new technology to its audiences. Our mission here is to inspire the inventive genius in everyone. There was a real reason people wanted to run away and join the circus.
Despite the ingenuity the circus brought at one time, that's since changed. That's why the Museum of Science and Industry is saying goodbye to their collection in an upcoming auction at Potter & Potter.
Well, the circus has been a really incredibly wonderful exhibit. It's inspiring. It's a nostalgic look back at a circus that doesn't exist today.
Other circus auction items include antiques from the Zweifel collection, consisting of nearly 500 additional pieces. And with the Museum of Science and Industry planning to use the auction earnings to acquire new artifacts, they want those new pieces to embody the same message as the circus.
Through the auction, we hope that this will continue to inspire others.
For Chicago Tonight, I'm Angel Ito.
Potter & Potter's Circus Collection auction is this Saturday at 10 a.m. You can visit our website for more information. Still to come on Chicago Tonight.
If I'm confirmed today, I am the youngest member on City Council, the sixth member of the LGBTQ plus caucus, and the first openly gay alderman of the 43rd Ward.
The 43rd Ward gets a new alderman. Our Spotlight Politics team on that and more.
Exclusion of people and shutting them out has been as American as apple pie.
And the U.S. and the Holocaust. We talk with historians about Ken Burns' latest film. But first, some more of today's top stories. The Federal Reserve again ordered an interest rate hike and signaled additional increases are likely to come. Today, it approved a third consecutive 0.75% hike in hopes of quelling inflation.
The FOMC raised its policy interest rate by 0.75%, and we anticipate that ongoing increases will be appropriate. We are moving our policy stance purposefully to a level that will be sufficiently restrictive to return inflation to 2%.
In August, the annual inflation rate was 8.3%, down slightly from the previous month. The Chicago Public Library is declaring its libraries book sanctuaries. They're hoping to expand local access to banned and challenged books through library events like Story Times. It coincides with Banned Book Week, highlighting increased efforts to ban books. The library is also asking residents to host their own book talks and events to generate conversations around the history of book bans. The third largest lottery jackpot in U.S. history has been claimed. And since I'm still here, it's obviously was not me. Two people choosing to stay anonymous came forward today to claim the whopping $1.3 billion Mega Millions jackpot. The ticket was bought nearly 2 months ago at a Speedway in Des Plaines. The winners say they're sticking with the plan to split the prize. The Illinois Lottery says the winners have chosen the option to take the lump sum payment of $780.5 million. And now, Paris, we toss it back to you.
Brandis, the new PBS documentary, The U.S. and the Holocaust, explores the difficult question of how the United States grappled with the rise of Nazism in Germany and the genocide of 6 million Jews. History lessons may recall that the U.S. helped liberate Nazi concentration camps after defeating Germany in World War II, but the entire story is far more complicated. This following clip shows how Adolf Hitler drew inspiration from the Jim Crow laws of the American South.
And when the Nazis were reproached for discrimination against Jews in Germany, their first answer was Mississippi.
And the third and final part of this series from Ken Burns, Lynn Novick, and Sarah Botstein airs tonight on WTTW. And joining us now are two historians in Chicago and prominent contributors to the film. They are Peter Hayes, Professor Emeritus of History and Holocaust Studies at Northwestern University and the former chair of the Academic Committee at the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. And Daniel Green, President of the Newberry Library in Chicago and curator of the Americans and the Holocaust exhibition at the Holocaust Memorial Museum. Gentlemen, we had a great conversation at the Illinois Holocaust Museum on Monday, and I'm glad that you're joining me here tonight. Daniel Green, why is it important to show the history of the Holocaust in the context of how the U.S. responded?
Well, of course, the Holocaust is an event that took place on European soil and often in parts in far Eastern Europe, but it grappling with Americans' response to the Holocaust helps us better understand American history, as you see through this documentary. So much of our response to Nazism is a debate about who we are as Americans. What is our responsibility to immigrants and refugees? How do we understand our responsibility to get involved in a war that many Americans consider a foreign war? And then when we know if people are targeted for genocide, how do we debate our responsibility to respond? These are enduring questions in American history that Burns and Novick and Botstein have really centered in the documentary as well.
And Peter Hayes, some of the answers to those questions might be a little uncomfortable for Americans, might they not?
Well, indeed. I mean, there's no question that we failed the challenge that was presented to us in the 1930s and 40s. We did not live up to the highest aspirations of American history. Give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. On the other hand, there is an upside to that part of the story, and that is that the United States admitted more Jewish refugees from Europe than any other nation in the world. We didn't do it as well as we should have, but we did better than everyone else. I think the story is, however, a mirror held up to us about our attitudes toward ourselves, what kind of country we want to be, and what kind of a role we play in the world.
And speaking of those attitudes, Daniel Green, there are several statistics cited in the film. One, a poll that said the majority of Americans were opposed to the Holocaust once they realized what was actually going on. But at the same time, the vast majority of Americans did not support admitting more Jews into the country. Can you talk about that contradiction?
Yeah, you're talking about a poll that was taken by the Gallup organization in November of 1938, just after Kristallnacht, which is a nationwide pogrom, a nationwide violent attack against Jewish people, Jewish businesses, Jewish places of worship. And Americans almost uniformly disapprove. The Gallup poll finds that 94% of Americans disapprove of the Nazi treatment of Jews by 1938. But then when they're asked, should we let in more refugees, it's about 7 in 10 that say no. And I think this is also a very instructive moment, or as Peter is saying here, a mirror for asking a difficult question. Why, when we disapprove of something bad happening over there, is it so difficult for Americans to bridge that gap between disapproval and a will to action on behalf of the victims? And we see that throughout the 1930s and 40s. And I think we see that in subsequent atrocities when we look to the United States for a response. It's very easy to disapprove, and it's very difficult for Americans to translate that disapproval into concerted action on behalf of victim groups.
And Peter Hayes, was part of this just an anti-Semitic sentiment in the United States, or perhaps anti-immigration sentiment overall?
I think all of the above. There was a good deal of anti-Semitism in the United States. There were restrictive covenants that prevented people from selling their houses to Jews. There were clubs and associations and inns and resorts and so forth that refused admission to Jews. These were normal parts of American life and then normal features of American discrimination. And that had an influence on our attitudes toward what happened in Europe. There also was a revulsion toward America's involvement in World War I, a sense that European politics is dirty and not something that we need to get mixed up with again because it will do us harm. And that fed the isolationist movements of the 1930s. And then there was the Depression. People did not want to admit refugees or immigrants in any large numbers because they feared that those people would compete with them for jobs. And that became an excuse. There were only 500,000 Jews in Germany, but there were 5 million Jews in Eastern Europe, in Poland and Romania and Lithuania. And the opponents of admitting people said, if we let in the 500,000 German Jews, then what do we do when the Polish government and the Romanian government, both of which were anti-Semitic and trying to reduce their Jewish populations, what do we do when they say we're going to drive people out? And so this kind of scare tactic became a weapon that persuaded people that the safest course was not to let anyone in.
And Daniel Green, we saw in that top clip that Hitler drew inspiration from the Jim Crow laws of the South and other parts of American culture. This is maybe a piece of history I forgot, but I learned again in the film. The majority of U.S. states had eugenics laws on the books at that time. What were those laws?
Well, there's a notion, it's, you know, pseudoscientific eugenics laws, a notion of a hierarchy of races and a kind of drawing, the state drawing a boundary often around who should be able to reproduce, right? We have sterilization laws in the United States at that time. But this notion of a hierarchy of races becomes especially important in understanding a series of restrictive immigration policies that are passed throughout the, especially throughout the 19 teens and 1920s, that then remain on the books after the Nazis rise to power, when many refugees from Nazi Germany and then Nazi occupied Europe are trying to enter. So, you know, Peter's talked about this already. There's almost a perfect storm in the United States. Pseudoscientific beliefs that put Jews near the bottom of a racial hierarchy, combined with isolationism, combined with a depression, combined with this xenophobic and anti-immigrant, anti-Semitic sentiments throughout the United States, all work together to make it very difficult for the Jews to enter, for Jewish refugees to enter the United States. And I think one of the takeaways of this series is to think about those complexities. We're not, the series doesn't put forward a simple single explanation for why the United States didn't do more to respond to Nazism. It really challenges viewers to think about the confluence of all of these factors.
And Peter Hayes, fast forward to the current day, when you see the debate around immigration today, and then you see headlines in the last few weeks of asylum seekers from South and Central America being bused to other cities or flown to other cities for what appear to be political stunts, do you see parallels to what's going on in this film and what's happening today?
Well, you can't help but see parallels. The arguments that were used against admitting people in the 1930s are identical to the arguments that are used today. They'll take your jobs, they'll cost you money, and there will be spies among them, is what they said in those days. Now we say terrorists. And so these arguments are presented. It's also argued today, as it was then, that the country is full, that we don't have room. And of course, we have twice as many Americans today as we did in the 1930s, so we obviously did have room. These are the kinds of arguments that recur in our history. There were arguments like this in the 1840s, again in the 1880s, again right after World War I, again in the 1930s. It's a recurrent cycle in American life. We have to face up, however, to when we are advocating selfishness and ignoring the plight of people outside.
Well, it's a fascinating film with so many lessons, and your contributions to the film are outstanding. A pleasure to talk to you again. Our thanks to Peter Hayes and Daniel Green. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Paris.
Thank you. Pleasure.
And again, part three of the series airs tonight at 8 on WTTW. And up next, our Spotlight Politics team on City Council welcoming its newest member. But first, we take a look at the weather.
Yet another Illinois politician is charged in relation to the installation of red light cameras in the state. The 43rd Ward gets a new alderman. The Cook County Clerk warns of a critical shortage of election judges and poll workers. And muddled messaging leaves Illinoisans confused over the Safety Act and reform of the cash bail system. Here to talk about all of that and more is our Spotlight Politics team, Amanda Vinicky, Heather Sharone, and Paris Schutz. Welcome back, team. So, Heather, let's start with you. Please, State Senator Emile Jones becomes the latest politician to be charged by the feds in relation to the installation of the red light cameras in Illinois. What is he alleged to have done?
Well, he is accused of purposefully shielding a red light camera firm that denies any wrongdoing from a piece of legislation that he introduced in return for a $5,000 bribe and a job for one of his unnamed associates. Jones is scheduled to be arraigned on Friday in front of a federal judge, and he was charged as part of what's called an information. And typically that is done in cases where the defendant is prepared to plead guilty.
And Heather, has he responded to these allegations at all?
He has not, although he did today resign from the leadership of the Democratic Party in the Illinois Senate, as well as his committee positions at the request of Senate President Don Harmon.
Well, it should be noted that former Senate President Emil Jones Jr., who was his father, spoke for him and said he's innocent, he's a hardworking lawmaker, and if what Heather says is true, which normally happens, if he eventually pleads guilty, it'll be interesting to see what his father says about it then.
Well, and to that point, Amanda, you know, as Paris just said, Jones is the son of former Illinois Senate President Emil Jones Jr. How have Democratic leaders reacted to this?
Well, so we heard there also that to the current Senate President's request that he did step down from his leadership position as well as his committee post. By the way, those committee posts are paying jobs. You get some extra cash if you're a member of the General Assembly. It's sort of, you get a committee position generally as a reward for a long tenure in the legislature. By giving that up, he's losing what I believe to be about double the amount of money he's alleged to have taken as part of this scheme for trying to shield the red light camera company. So losing all around there. By the way, I want to point out, Democrats, however, have not called for his resignation. That's fitting a pattern, frankly, of some of the other senators who've gotten in trouble with the law or some other misdeeds. They are retaining their positions in the legislature. They couldn't be forced out by leadership, but also leadership has not asked for that.
But it should be noted, he's running for re-election unopposed in a couple of months, so it's likely that he will get another term, which he can, you know, while he's not convicted.
True. And also one other sort of interesting thing to point out here, because this is in relation to what he alleged to have done as his role as a state legislator. If he is convicted or if he pleads, then he would ostensibly lose at least a portion of his state pension.
Okay, so moving over to city council, a new alderperson, as we heard earlier in the newscast, 43rd Ward by the name of Timmy Knudsen. He replaces alderwoman Michelle Smith, who stepped down last month. Here's retiring alderperson Susan Sadlowski-Garza welcoming him to the council, followed by the new alderman himself.
Welcome aboard, buckle your seatbelt, and kiss your family goodbye.
If I'm confirmed today, I am the youngest member on city council, the sixth member of the LGBTQ plus caucus, and the first openly gay alderman of the 43rd Ward. I want to take a moment to recognize the significance of this. Representation matters. Having the opportunity to share my own experiences and uplift those of other diverse communities is a responsibility that I take so seriously.
So, Heather, we just heard a little bit of Knudsen's bio from the man himself. What else can you tell us about him and how his name got to the top of the mayor's list?
Well, he is a well-known lawyer in Chicago, and for the past couple of years has served on the Zoning Board of Appeals, which determines whether special things can be built and what businesses can be open. And he was nominated for that post from Mayor Lori Lightfoot. So most City Hall observers thought he had the inside track the whole time. He now has a significant advantage in the 43rd Ward election in February. He will be able to run as an incumbent, and he had the benefit of standing alongside Mayor Lightfoot at City Hall today, giving his campaign stump speech and getting his name out to voters who now will get to know their new alderperson, and he will get a chance to make his case to become their permanent alderperson.
Paris, what else do we know about him and his political priorities?
You know, I don't know much about his ideology, although it's interesting to note that he's running a pro bono law practice that assists LGBTQ immigrants. So you would imagine that those two issues are going to be very important to him. It would appear that he would be progressive. He is a supporter of the mayor, as Heather said, so it would be highly likely that he would probably support the priorities of the mayor, as his predecessor, the outgoing alderwoman Michelle Smith, did.
I'm sure we'll learn as time goes on, of course. So Cook County Clerk Karen Yarbrough says the county has a serious shortage of election workers. Here's what she said earlier this week.
We have a serious shortage of judges and poll walk workers. Now, the clerk's office manages elections in suburban Cook County, and we've seen our number of election judges shrink significantly in recent years. Over the last 8 years, we've seen a reduction of about 40%.
Amanda, of course, we've heard of threats against election workers in other states. Is that a possibility? Is that what's going on here as well?
I am sure that it is a possibility, albeit one that nobody hopes comes to fruition. Yarbrough said that no, in fact, that hasn't been an issue, at least that she's aware of. Sometimes, sure, you get maybe a tangle or two, maybe folks cutting in line or wearing a campaign button when you're voting, things that you're not supposed to do because that's considered electioneering, but nothing along those lines. Still, it is something that certainly, because it has been such an issue on the national level that everybody is sort of preparing for, watching for. It is something that when you talk, for example, thinking back to during the state fair when the Illinois Republican Party had their meeting, they said, we want to be prepared. We are recruiting. And that's what parties do. They recruit individuals to serve as judges, poll watchers. These are, they have bipartisan teams, but it is something that certainly there's a lot of tension on, especially given the accusations about the 2020 election, unfounded though they may be.
Paris, what happens if we don't have enough judges?
Well, it's bad if we don't have enough judges. It makes it harder to vote. Usually what happens here is that precincts open late. If they can't find the election judges or they're not there on time, perhaps a precinct has to close and you have to move to another precinct. I'm not sure how that exactly would work. But, you know, we should note that these elections are fairly low turnout when they're not a presidential year, and there are so many different ways to vote: early voting, vote by mail. So lines haven't been terribly long in most instances in general. You wouldn't think this is going to have a huge impact in Chicago on the upcoming election. Nationally, what's happened because of the conspiracies and the threats against 2020 election workers, it certainly portends to have a huge impact, especially going forward. If people simply don't want to do these jobs, it's going to be very difficult to carry out free and fair elections, especially in swing states where this is now getting very contentious. And this is something public officials know. There was the Electoral Vote Count Act that was passed by the House, the U.S. House, today. This is something that has to be addressed. But in Chicago, in the upcoming election, you might see, you know, a few lines, precincts opening late and then having to stay out late. I wouldn't anticipate huge widespread problems.
So, Amanda, you've been reporting on the Safety Act earlier in the show, of course. Tell us a little bit about the messaging here, because it really does seem that there's a lot of confusion among the general public as to what this act will do and not do.
Brandis, it's hard to even pinpoint how and why that is, but you're right, because it is also muddled. I think part of this is, yes, it is election season. And so part of it is certainly intentionally sort of inflamed rhetoric surrounding this, trying to make a point. Some of it, of course, is more nuanced than that. And then that nuance is getting folded in with the accusations of misinformation and politicking. And so it makes it all the more difficult. I think part of where you're talking about that nuance is, this is really major stuff. I mean, it is a huge bill. It does a lot. It is the criminal justice system, which is sort of on its own and on its face, very confusing, and individual cases are borne out in different ways. And then we don't know yet exactly how it is going to work, because at least when it comes to cash bail, it hasn't happened yet. So there are a lot of predictions and a lot of fears and a lot of hopes and aspirations by folks who are really hoping that this will work and that we will no longer allow for poor individuals to be punished and locked up. So I think that that is all a part of it. And I do expect that we are going to continue to see this conversation being somewhat muddled, and we'll do our best to try and help clear all those things up.
Of course. Paris, Illinois Republicans essentially portraying this as a get out of jail free card for violent criminals. Is the public hearing that message? Is that what's, you know, going to win votes for Republicans?
I don't know whether it's going to win votes for Republicans, but it certainly seems to be issue number one that Republicans are leaning into. You know, they're saying things like, some of the more extreme cases, they're saying things like it's the purge, where everyone is just going to be let out of jail come in New Year. That, of course, is not true. I don't think anyone believes that it's likely to get them the governor's mansion, because that's a big uphill battle in that race. But it could cut into some of these legislative races. It could cut into some of the Democratic supermajorities in the state house. So you see not just the Governor Darren Bailey candidate, but other candidates. You saw Jim Durkin, the House minority leader, writing an op-ed against this. And to piggyback on what Amanda said, there are things, amid all the noise, there are some things that do have honest disagreements. Some of the opponents of the bill, they just don't know exactly what crimes are eligible for no bail. And proponents of the bill say, well, it's not just a few of the most serious felonies. A lot of crimes can be eligible for no bail. In some of those crimes, well, you'd have to go the extra step of having an extra hearing to prove that the person's going to be a flight risk or a danger to the community. But because there's disagreement on that, it is going to be tough to see how this rolls out. And I do think you hear whispers of a possible special session where Democrats are saying, yeah, there might be some things we have to iron out about this bill.
Amanda, to that point, are Democrats doing anything to refine or clarify their message?
I think that the lesson is sort of there in politics. If you're on defense, well, that's not where you want to be. Again, I think that in most cases, Democrats are fairly safe in terms of, just you look at polling and funding that, for example, Governor J.B. Pritzker has and the rest of the Democratic incumbents. But were it not that case, they might be in trouble. I think the amount of attention that this issue is receiving shows that there are some concerns, that voters may have fears about what is happening with crime. And so there certainly are, this is a touchy and a hot topic. Democrats are starting to recognize that. As Paris noted, there are ongoing conversations right now. The expectation, however, is that most of those talks will come to fruition after the election, and that's when you'll see any votes, because it is so very touchy.
So, Heather, coming back to you on the issue of lead service lines for tap water in Chicago, you reported that very few have been removed. Are there any plans to speed that up?
There are not, and it is difficult to remove lead service lines in Chicago. Chicago is a very dense urban environment, and it's expensive. $15,000 to $20,000 for each service line. So there's no easy fix. The question is if Lori Lightfoot, as she's running for a second term, will feel pressure to speed up this effort amid new reporting from The Guardian that shows that these lead pipes are certainly contributing to a problem with lead in Chicago's drinking, cooking, bathing water.
What has the mayor said about this, Heather, and why isn't this more of a priority for her?
Well, it's a question I would love to ask her. She did not get back to me with questions about this, although she did tell a group of mayors last week in a recorded address that this was a high priority for her and that she was determined to address this issue, which she called an issue of fairness and equity. Whether that will translate into action, I think, is still an open question at this point.
And there are federal infrastructure dollars that are supposed to pay for a lot of it. I mean, not the whole thing, but I just wonder how many of those monies are being put to use.
And it sounds
none
like a matter of
so far.
Right, none so far. At least, yeah. At least they got rid of the wood service lines that they were digging up from like 100 and 120 years ago.
It sounds like a matter of, no matter how much money you've got, it's still a really hard thing to do. That said, it's not being done. Paris, the Daily Herald is apparently helping conservative talk show host Dan Proft distribute his fake newspapers by allowing him to utilize the Herald's distribution network. What is going on there?
Well, we should explain to viewers again. I mean, I think a lot of you have seen these things that look like newspapers. They say things like Chicago City Wire. They come in the mail. But really, they're cleverly disguised campaign literature, pro-Republican, anti-Democrat. And there were reports this week that that Mr. Proft was using the distribution network of the parent company of the Daily Herald, Paddock Publications. And so apparently Paddock Publications does have a distribution network that it does have private entities use to do mailers, mail things out. So I guess that's not so unusual, but it is unusual in the sense that Paddock Publications' main business is to own newspapers like the Daily Herald, and as that being your main business, you want that to be untainted by politics or political bias So, I mean, I think what they've said so far in statements is that, you know, this is a separate part of their business. Paddock Publications is the parent company. Daily Herald is a newspaper. It has nothing to do with that. But certainly, it's, you know, a company has a choice of who they're going to do business with. It's interesting that they chose to do business here.
Amanda or Heather, we've got about 30 seconds left. You want to jump in here? Does the fact that Proft is using the Daily Herald or Paddock Publishing's distribution network give it any validity to the people who view it? Maybe they just don't notice.
Well, I think that's the risk here, because these publications are designed to fool people, essentially, into thinking that they're fact-checked and that they're objective and that they include real information. And I think that anything that happens that make them look more like newspapers and, you know, sort of being sort of produced by the same people who produces a fine newspaper, the Daily Herald, I think has to raise concerns because, you know, you and I, we all know this. We spend so much time sort of trying to get people the facts. That's very frustrating when we find ourselves sort of pushing back.
Absolutely. All right. We'll have to leave it there. Spotlight Politics. Thanks, Heather Sharone, Amanda Venicky, and Pierre Schutz. And we're back to wrap things up right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
And that is our show for this Wednesday night. Don't forget to stay connected with us by signing up for our daily briefing. And you can get Chicago Tonight streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and our website, WTTW.com/news.
You can also get the show via podcast in the PBS Video app. And please join us tomorrow night live at 7. Home to an iconic Cheesecake Factory and Chicago's first veterans home, we are live from the Dunning community.
And Maestro Riccardo Muti reflects on his 10-plus years of making music with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. And one final note before we go. This is the last day here for a longtime WTTW engineer, Peter Adrianopoli. Peter spent some 25 years with us, and we thank him for his hard work, can-do attitude, and professionalism. Peter, all the best in your retirement.
Absolutely.
Don't forget us. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman.
And I'm Paris Schutz. Thank you so much for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a great evening.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports free educational initiatives in the legal profession.